Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it is our Monday with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu right here in Studio 2. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me, as always.
So I understand you came right over here from the West Roxbury Education Complex. Yes. Earlier this summer. You had announced that the Boston Public Schools will take the John D. O'Brien there, moving it from its current location in Roxbury. So tell me, what were you there for today? It was some kind of tour.
Yeah, we were there with the superintendent and Dr. Richard O'Brien, who is heading up the steering committee and has taken a couple visits there with alumni and others. We were doing a walkthrough just to highlight and give some folks a chance to see up close what the possibilities are. You set foot there, and for me, what is immediately apparent is how much light and space and it's the range of facilities that is possible there that in many parts of our much denser, older city, just you can't find all of the football, soccer, tennis, basketball, swimming pool on top of the space for fully built out science labs, maker spaces. So it's always wonderful to walk through there and you can just feel the potential and what it will be.
So last month when you were here, we talked about this. And one of the things that we talked about was opposition to the plan. And you said, listen, this is early in the process, right? There's more to go. There will be more time for input, et cetera. It's a month later. I think you've had more time to both explain why you think there's potential there, and opponents have had more time to kind of crystallize and lay out what their concerns are. What is the process now for people to provide input, and where will that input have impact on your plans?
We have had, we have started to have some of the public meetings. There will certainly be more of them, and additional groups will walk through the West Roxbury Educational Campus site to get the chance to see. We want to make sure that educators, for example, and teachers who are currently at the O'Brien site get to see with their own two eyes what we're talking about, and to be able to register their feedback and opinions that way. We are in the process now of having, you know, whether it ends up being the O'Brien or a different school, what we're doing in the process is taking steps that would have to happen anyways. So demolition of that site is something that's in the budget and that we're preparing for, ripping it down to the studs so that we could accelerate the process.
You
later
mean the
on.
West Roxbury Education, yes, Complex, regardless of whether you put the O'Brien there?
Yes.
Okay.
And then going out to design to be able to have some of the conversations and get further on in helping people understand what it could be. We have some very, very initial renderings now that are not at all design and built around what the specifics would be. And then ultimately it will be on the school committee to make that decision on whether we move forward with this plan, because we know that Madison Park and therefore the O'Brien currently sharing the same campus, that this needs to be a signature project for how we really deliver opportunity, impact across the district. So we have to get it done for Madison Park and the O'Brien. That school deserves its own building. We've looked at many other sites, including some that are in Roxbury or closer to the current location, and we'll be sharing some of the details and specifications just so the public can understand what our thought process and analysis has shown us. In many of the other sites, you know, you could theoretically find space for 2,000 students and an expansion of the school if you just build very high up, right? 6, 7, 8 stories on a particular footprint. You can't get a football field. You can't get a swimming pool. And as the superintendent says, it's very difficult for high schoolers, especially, to build community when a school is skinny and vertical, as opposed to the type of space that we would be able to have in West Roxbury.
So one, to clarify for listeners, and you alluded to this, when the O'Brien moves out, that leaves room for Madison Park to then expand in the existing space.
That's right. Both schools would expand.
Yeah. The last question for you on this. Has anything in the last month changed your thinking from where you were a month ago?
I've had a lot of conversations with students, with alumni, with others. And so we had a good sense of what the challenges and concerns would be headed into this conversation. I think we feel good about the mechanisms and how to ensure that the culture of the school, the diversity of the school would be a transition, but a seamless one. You know, what I am thinking about is how we start to layer in partnerships and really specific conversations we're beginning to have with employers about if there were space, if there were the chance to help us design the world-class labs and maker spaces or robotics program or environmental science and climate tech program. There's a ton of interest from employers to really jump in, roll their sleeves up, and get involved. Transportation-wise, we were at the school when the commuter rail train rolled right by the school, and so we've continued to have conversations with the MBTA and with the administration. That would be a game changer for that entire region of the city, much less this campus and students. But one piece that I have been thinking about more that's been kind of coming up in conversations is students want to have something fun to do, and they need to have access to that, not only with after-school programming and things that are on campus, but to find a way to feel connected to the larger city. So thinking about transportation, particularly from that facet, certainly direct public transportation with the commuter rail would help. But even as we're designing our shuttle system and what BPS could do, regardless of what the MBTA does, that has to be a major consideration.
So I want to stay with schools a little bit longer. Let's talk about Mary Skipper, BPS superintendent, just completed her self-evaluation. It was released. She graded herself as effective across the board, reported high gains in multilingual learning. So in her first year, what would you say was her biggest or most impactful achievement? And where would you say is the greatest place for room to grow in year two?
My sense is that it feels like night and day in terms of the energy in the district and the excitement from our workforce and from school communities about where we're headed. Now, I'm not saying this is necessarily about previous leadership or previous administrations, but just coming out of the pandemic in itself, everybody was burnt out. Teachers who had been on the front lines, a district that even prior to COVID had experienced a little bit of a revolving door of senior administrators and leadership. And so I think we were, in fact, not even as stabilized and prepared for COVID as we could have or maybe should have been because of all of the disruption and transition, destabilization, even prior to the pandemic. And certainly that made it all the more stressful for everyone. And so we saw numbers this school year, wrapping up this last school year, where the greatest number of school leaders across the board have chosen to stay and say, I'm excited to do this job and to really grow and continue building our school communities. We've made some major steps in the school facilities piece, matched with partnerships around early college and career. And so I think the superintendent's key achievement is starting to really solidify that foundation that will allow us to reach the next level, the next 10 levels of this district. Previously, even shortly before she came on, it really felt like if we could just have a goal of stability and not losing staff who were fed up or just had enough or feeling like we were just seeing every bit of progress then countered by something else that might happen. We're at a very different place now when it comes to how far ahead we're able to plan and look, because many of the underlying systemic structural challenges have a real plan and we're moving forward.
So room to grow in year two, Mayor Wu, where for Superintendent Skipper?
I think similar to how it's been really launching the administration as a whole, where step one was building out the team, stabilizing the workforce. Step two, really ensuring that we're taking stock of what the key challenges are that have been holding us back, and then moving forward with progress and finding ways to build the systems and organizational muscle to deliver that as quickly as possible and in partnership with community. She has very quickly gotten her team up, completely shifted around some of the organizational structures to have more clarity and more accountability on certain areas. For the first time, a new chief of academics focused specifically on social and emotional learning, dedicated staff and planning around multilingual learning and special education. And so we're seeing all the key pieces built up there. The next step is going to be moving forward beyond just the planning and envisioning phase to actually launching the projects for the Green New Deal for Boston Public Schools, getting going on our special education reforms and seeing it through on some of these major systems that need a probably 3-year period to show the impact.
We're speaking with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu here. Just briefly, because we're going to go deep on schools. Obviously, next month it'll be August. It'll be back to school. We'll do a lot more there. But reporting from the Boston Globe, it was their cover story in the print edition today about $1 billion left on the table of American Rescue Plan Act money across Boston, the Massachusetts schools. The Globe says that Boston spent a little less than a third of its nearly $432 million, according to state data, but that a lot of schools systems are saying, listen, we'll have it either allocated or spent by the deadlines September 2024. So just very briefly, are you confident that you'll have it all spent or allocated appropriately by the deadline?
We are going to do whatever it takes to make sure that all the resources that are available get to our schools and school communities. Again, you kind of have to take it stepwise in order because without the staffing and the stability around bus drivers and bus monitors and all the other pieces, it's hard for a school to move beyond the operational crises that can come about into that longer term planning. And so we are there now. We have closed the gap on all of the major challenges when it had come to staffing that were really at crisis level. And so now I think we'll be able to see a lot faster progress on these pieces.
Let's stick with the news of the day. Hopefully the news today is that the legislature passes a budget that then goes to Governor Maura Healey, who would then have 10 days to sign it. It's a month late at this point, but we do now know the basic details of it. We'll get to the MBTA part in just a second, but there's a range of things, $50 million for free community college for people over 25 and for community college nursing programs. You've got $6.5 billion for K-12 funding, in-state tuition for undocumented immigrants, free school meals for another academic year. In those areas, the number one most important thing you're seeing in that budget for the city of Boston is X.
Free school meals is really important all across the board. I think we have, on the other areas, seen tremendous success with tuition-free community college for all ages. We certainly want to make sure that as more families are joining our communities, as migrant families are getting on their feet and getting stabilized and then plugging right into our school systems, that every support is there and available. Many of the initiatives at the state, I think, you know, from what I have heard, often you want to start with the appropriate ramp-up structure as well. And so finding ways to really understand what the actual need will be, what the actual staffing is that's required. I'm glad that we're getting going on all of these because they're all necessary.
Okay, you had also been pushing for a seat for the city of Boston on the MBTA Board of Directors. That came through in the compromise. Now, obviously, a couple steps left to go, but does look like it's in the home stretch. Assuming that in the final signed version it's there, what would that mean? And do you have a person in mind for that slot?
Look, we're not going to, we've been here before. Last year around this time, it was both the House and the Senate and even the governor at that point had signed, but then sent it back with amendments. And that's where things kind of unraveled a little bit. So I'm not going to count any of those final steps as a given.
You're not taking anything for granted.
That's right. I'm incredibly grateful to the House for initiating this in their budget, the Senate for agreeing to it in the negotiations. And again, fingers crossed in this last stretch. This is really critical, even as I mentioned about the expanding the O'Brien School into a new part of the city. The commuter rail infrastructure is there. That transportation access is make or break for our city in every single neighborhood as we're looking to grow and bring new industries there and make sure that people are connected to everything that they need in their daily lives. And so our goal is to be a city that's the best place in the country for families. We have to have a direct say in how our transportation system is operating, because there are certainly a lot of things that they're working on and that they need to keep in mind across the entire region and beyond. But as the space where the economic growth and population and kind of weight of much of the commuting and transportation happens, we have to have a direct role in shaping the decisions.
All right. I want to spend a couple of minutes now on the Boston City Council. A number of questions for you there. We've talked about this before. Key recent events, charges against Kendra Lara for driving with an expired license in an unregistered and uninsured vehicle. Both Councilors Arroyo and Fernandez Anderson have paid fines recently for ethics violations involving family members. You've been clear that you feel the council's credibility has been harmed. You've also been clear you feel this is a set of issues best left to the voters this fall. You've also been a city councilor. You know how it plays an important role in checks and balances for the power of the mayor. If there is no turnover in elected councilors who are running for office again in this next election, can the council maintain its efficacy and credibility?
I think it will take work. We are going to see, we've already seen some turnover with a new District 8 counselor. Sharon Durkin has been elected in the special election and will have to run again in November. But
replacing Kenzie Bach.
That's right, who is now stepping into the role as administrator for the Boston Housing Authority. We will see a new at-large counselor, at least one, because Councilor Michael Flaherty is stepping down. So there will be some changeover in different personalities. And on a group that is that small, 13 people, even one or two voices and different dynamics can have an impact. I will say in general that there's been so much focus on, you know, what could be called transgressions or very concerning behavior or, you know, the headlines have all been about things that are happening with the counselors that as individuals in their own lives and in their roles as representatives that are troubling. You know, this is, we can't pretend that in the history of the Boston City Council, there haven't been transgressions and troubling behavior from every generation and every cohort dating way back. For me, you know, it's hard being a human being in a family, living your life and looking to balance everything. And so I would never say that people have to be perfect in order to be in elected office. The question is, when you think about the totality of what has been accomplished this term on the council, is that enough? Has there been work in addition to what's happening, or are the headlines because there hasn't been that much else that has come forward? And, you know, we've had great partnership.
Is it enough?
We've had the success in moving forward some of our home rule petitions, getting our budget through, allocating federal recovery funds. We have initiated much of that. I have served on the council. I know how powerful and important this institution is, and it's very difficult. I don't know if there's ever been a period of time where half of the council has been brand new all at the same time. I think it makes it hard, and when the focus has tended to be almost on infighting rather than finding ways to move things forward, that makes it very difficult, because then the focus does end up being on individual things that have occurred.
The city council's got to vote on your inclusionary development policy proposal, which includes, in part, and there's a lot to it. We did a whole thing on this last week here on Radio Boston. In part, increasing affordable units from 13% to 17% in new commercial housing developments. Do you anticipate, I mean, there is criticism from both ends of the spectrum on this. Do you anticipate that it will pass this Boston City Council?
I haven't had individual conversations yet. I know we have a number of items that we still are looking to move through before the end of the year. This one is through the process in state law. It's basically the council has a veto on it. So it's a different number of votes than usual. And so I hope that the council will agree that this is a very complex balance right now. We are in quite a difficult economic climate for the development community and for projects to work because interest rates keep going up and up and up, and costs were already very high to build anyway. At the same time, we believe that this strikes the right balance for having a baseline of standards that in any economic climate should reflect affordability being a key part of any growth in the city.
You are listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and Boston Mayor Michelle Wu is here with us in Studio 2 in the middle of our conversation about many things happening in the city. One little one has been this convention that's been here the last few days. The NAACP annual convention has been here, officially ends July 31st, which is today. We've been talking about it for quite a while. We talked about it with you last time you were here. So listen, when we talked last time, you said, listen, it's going to be 6 months before we really can measure success because of the long tail that you're looking for the programs, the businesses, the community investments. But as it comes officially to a close, does it feel successful to you as a mayor who helped host it?
It's been an incredible experience, and what an opportunity for Boston. Even just the conversations I've been able to have with residents and convention goers who are coming from other parts of the country to see Boston through their eyes has been incredibly gratifying. I think from all sides, we have felt that there's been a sense of people feeling welcome, feeling like there's so much to do and see here and to celebrate here. We've had tremendous success with the events that the city directly hosted and participated in. Yesterday's Gospel Fest and the reception for delegates was quite a fun time. And, you know, we see local businesses who have been able to expand into new areas of industry because of the contracts associated with this convention. We've been able to highlight brand new Black-owned businesses in the Seaport, which is a relatively new development, even in the last year or so.
So give us an example of either of those, a local business that's expanded because of contracting or a Black-owned business that you were able to highlight.
Well, I've known Ricardo Luis for a little bit of time. He has run a valet parking company, and some of the contracts that have come up in the past, either they were maybe not at the scale to do them, or they had something here and there, we're piecing it together. But for the convention, through working with our Chief of Economic Opportunity Inclusion, Shugan Iruwu, and his shop, there was suggestion of, actually, we have a need for not only parking, but shuttle service between some of the different stops and events, even if it was a couple blocks from the convention center to our culture nights or a tour of the neighborhoods. And so he worked with some relationships and contacts of his to actually grow his business into an entirely new area. And we hope to see much more on that front in the future as well, as those contacts blossom. And he can be another example of how we not only have businesses start here, but really grow. And then in terms of the Seaport itself, Grace by Nia has hosted a couple of the events. It is an absolutely incredible space.
Brand new.
And just amazing to see that there's places in the Seaport that weren't there even when the convention was last supposed to be in Boston that now really much better reflect our city.
You said to see the city of Boston through the convention goers' eyes. So give me some little piece of Boston. I want you to really paint that for me. What does Boston look like through the eyes of somebody who came here for the convention?
So, I mean, to do so and appreciate the contrast, maybe I'll have to share a little bit of what I see, which is when I'm out and about, graffiti or a pothole. These are all things that I'm writing down. That's my list of as I'm driving by. Oh, we've got to fix these and that things. And I love it, right? There's a sense of this is what we do in the job. We're able to hopefully create the sense of taking that for granted, that your street can be smooth and clean and safe and beautiful. And certainly we have a lot of work to do in all various neighborhoods, but our teams are incredible. They're working so hard. They have put in a lot of effort, our public works teams and everyone, just in making sure that the city looks even more beautiful for convention goers and to be able to show, put our best foot forward in a time when we've gotten a lot of rain and therefore many of the grasses and weeds everywhere, including my yard, are living their fullest life right now. So to hear from convention goers that our city is beautiful and clean and welcoming and fun. And, you know, I've talked to someone from Florida. I talked to a couple people from Colorado where they are just really excited to see that we can move forward on programs, whether it's, you know, our free swimming program, free swimming lessons and infrastructure, or creating grants for Black-owned businesses and MWB, minority and women business enterprises to move into high foot traffic areas. We have a lot of infrastructure here that we're moving on all at the same time. And it's been fun to kind of share that progress and see everyone taking notes to take back home with them.
We're speaking with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu here in Studio 2 on Radio Boston. Let's talk about, let's do the grants, right? Because the first round of space grants have come out. These are those small business grants to help people open storefronts in vacant space in either downtown Boston or other parts of the city. The grants can be up to $200,000, and they are 75% minority-owned, more than 60% are women-owned. I'm going to bring out some sound from a conversation we had with one of the winners of a grant in this first round. So this is Thais Rocha, who's co-founder of LGBTQ Nightlife Events, working to open Danny's, which is a lesbian and queer bar in Boston. Got a grant. We spoke with Thais in May about the need for a place like Danny's.
Being told by different establishments that, you know, oh, we don't want to scare away our patrons or anything like that. And it's like, well, no one's scaring anybody away. You know, it's just people looking to get together and have a good time. You know, thankfully, fingers crossed, we've had no issues in the amount of time we've been doing these events, and it's been easy for us, but it's the back end side of things where a lot of people just aren't happy with what we do, but persevere and continue doing it. You're going to hear no a bunch of times, but it's just, you got to keep going.
And we were talking with Danny then in the context of the fact that there were fewer than 30 lesbian bars in the entire country. Mm. And Danny was looking to open this. So there's a space grant there, right? It's the beginning. How do you then help make sure that these entrepreneurs that you're investing in succeed?
Yeah. So just even that example and so many of the others that it's been incredible to get to know and highlight, skincare, childcare, salon, floral shop, food service businesses. These are the grants that we are able to invest because of the federal recovery funds and city funds. These are going to have a huge return on investment for everyone, for our economy. You know, the more density of fun stuff that there is to do, businesses that are filling some of the vacant spaces that have opened up since the pandemic, the more likely it is that someone will schedule a date with a friend or family to hang out after work, keep their dollars in the local economy rather than take them somewhere else or just go home and not contribute to the economy here. And so, you know, we're working with a number of organizations. Also, it's a city, and many places, oftentimes it's who you know that clears the way. And sometimes there's a space open for rent, but by the time you find out about it, it's already been promised to someone who knew someone who knew someone. And so for many of the businesses that we are hoping to support who reflect the full diversity of our community, these might not be generational businesses. They might be immigrant-owned businesses or people who have grown up in our city without connections to those who are property owners downtown. And if we can continue working with the Chamber of Commerce, BECMA, the Downtown Boston Bid.
BECMA being the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts. Mm-hmm.
The Downtown Boston Business Improvement District, AIM, and some of the other business associations. they are wrapping around these businesses, making the connections, helping to market and give technical support. And so we want to just clear down the barriers for everyone to have a level playing field and for all of us to be able to benefit from their offerings.
Okay, so I'm going to pivot then to another question. And this has been on my mind and sort of thinking about getting ready to talk to you today. Is the both, I don't know if you want to call it the yin and the yang or the both and or the this hand always means also on this hand, right? And there was a story that emerged first in the Dorchester Reporter, then the Boston Herald and the Globe did some follow on in both reporting and opinion on a now defunct effort to create a PAC called Save Our City that would have worked to elect more conservative candidates to city offices. Communications mogul George Regan reportedly was behind the effort, although when first asked about it by Jim Dumschus of the Dorchester Reporter, he said that information about it was actually a mistake in an email made by his secretary. If, as for example, the Boston Globe's Joan Vinaki suggested in an opinion piece, it was a real thing that was a move to save an older version of Boston, run mostly by, frankly, older white business interests. If that is true, does that mean you're doing something right in your book, given what you just said?
I don't know. I mean, I didn't hear of that until, the invitation started getting sent out. As it progressed, it seemed to be more about one person's mind than any particularly organized effort. And, if there are certain individuals who want to take the city back to the 70s, I mean, especially from Cape Cod and hosting a major effort out there.
The fundraiser for it would have been on Cape Cod, just to be clear for listeners.
I was in Boston at that time, as were many of the folks who were on that list and many of the other representatives and people who are stepping into leadership today. There's a lot of work to do, and we're in a moment in our country's political history that it can feel maybe scary to some that things are changing as quickly as they are. That is all delayed and deferred change that should have happened a long time ago, frankly, whether it is on specific policy issues like climate, right? We could be moving at a very different pace now, much more convenient and comfortable if it had gotten going several decades ago when the impacts of climate change really became known. Now it's too late to move comfortably and conveniently. And on representation of our community, opening up every sector and the seats at decision-making tables and getting these tables even out of traditional closed-door spaces and out into the community, I couldn't feel more energized by what I see in every part of Boston and out in our neighborhood. So frankly, I don't worry too much about what's happening on Cape Cod or in certain people's minds. There's a lot of energy to keep it going. And if what we see from the convention goers right here in Boston right now with the NAACP and many of the other efforts and the small business owners we're working with, the young people that we're connecting to our free swim lessons and bike lessons and every bit of opportunity, we have to move even faster. It's not about slowing down.
I wasn't planning on asking you about this, but you just said it, so I'm going to. Remarkable July from a climate standpoint, from a heat standpoint, et cetera. You came in on a Green New Deal. You've been very clear about what your climate priorities are. You just said we're not moving fast enough and we can't move in a way that's comfortable. When you've had a quiet moment, if that ever happens, at your desk, what is the climate item that you have felt most like about over the last month, given the way the heat has unfolded and the climate has unfolded over the last month?
Yeah. I'll give one kind of infrastructure example and then one maybe more policy legislative. It was really scary, for example, to read that in some parts of the country, in the Southwest, for example, they've had a record-breaking 30 days above 110 degrees in a row now, right? I think they said the last record was something like 18 days several decades ago. And it's been unbearable enough in Boston with the heat that we feel every water feature in our park, whether it functions or doesn't function, whether it's working that day or the button got jammed, that is critical public health right there. And getting our pools open, right? We have, again, decades where key repairs didn't happen, and now filtration systems that are broken or pools that are leaking and unsafe to be in. We are moving these as quickly as possible, but it's really not just about having fun and creating recreation, although that is incredibly important. It is about whether or not communities in every part of the city have access to heat resilience and cooling infrastructure. I think what gets me most worried on a kind of macro level is that our hands are tied at the city level on some of the biggest things that we're trying to do. We have the resources, the willpower, the partnerships that are ready to go, and yet we're still waiting to hear back if we will get into the state's 10 communities pilot program to be able to fully regulate how we can allow for or phase out fossil fuel infrastructure in buildings. We're trying to do everything we can, but without that bit of state legislative approval, or at this point, it's now on the executive side, executive approval, we can target the biggest buildings. We can try to do our best on some residential spaces where we can provide grants directly. We're working on public housing, but to be able to do all of it, we can't get to the whole middle of that without this authorization
so
that we've been waiting for.
So you need a decision from the Healey administration.
Yeah, and even the fact that only 10 communities are allowed to do this at all in a time when no one is talking about 2050 being a realistic goal anymore, at least in the scientific community. If it's not 2040, it might not exist. We don't know what the, you know, even how fast things are changing now, the climate refugees from around the world as parts of the world become uninhabitable. We have to be shifting our timelines decades faster. And that means we need to get started now.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and I'm sitting here in Studio 2 with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu on this Monday with the mayor. You've made reference to the swimming lessons and the bikes a couple of times. It is the heart of summer. So let's talk about, I especially want to talk about the swimming lessons. You were just talking about pools as public health. So what are you doing for kids around free swim lessons this summer, especially after opening a swim complex, reopening it in East Boston following a multi-million dollar renovation?
Well, this is about making sure that kids can enjoy everything that our incredible coastal city has to offer. But it's really a generational effort because we know the numbers are quite stark, that the disproportionate access to public pools, for example, and lessons has meant that Black and Brown families are far less likely to know how to swim or to feel comfortable near water, near and in water. And when the parents' generation of a family doesn't have that knowledge and comfort, it is something like 87% that the New York Times reported that the children's generation are likely not to be able to know how because they haven't been exposed. And so we're often, to be able to encourage the kids to learn how to swim, it is a whole family effort. And we want people from every generation and every age to take advantage of the lessons that are available, the opportunities, and then to be able to fully enjoy the city's public pools, which we are renovating and getting more and more reopened, the beaches in the area. This is a part of the country where we are closer to water than, you know, for example, where I grew up in the middle of lots of farmland. We need to take advantage of it.
How young were the boys when they learned to swim?
Just 2 weeks ago, young. We had taken some lessons at the local YMCA here and there. And with the pandemic, it was very difficult. I feel like they maybe got started later than they would have or could have. And even after the lessons, though, it didn't click all the way for my little one. He just had the sense that he needed to keep his head above water fully and no matter what, and that was hampering some of the other things. So we eventually had a little bit of time on April school vacation. He got a little more comfortable, and then it really was just very recently that both the swimming and the biking kind of clicked into place, and it's just the constant exposure is all that made it happen. It wasn't like we were good at learned how to do it better or made it more available. You just kind of have to keep at it.
So no one's plugging their nose or using training wheels anymore.
No. Yeah. Very different feeling.
Okay, so we're with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu here. I'm going to make a very dramatic pivot here because I want to do this, but I want to do it quickly. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I do have a couple questions I want to ask you on this because we have not spoken with you about this. There was reporting from the Boston Globe and others. Actually, it was from the Boston Herald that you had submitted a list of 15 people to police last year who had a history of protesting you. You have said that it was at law enforcement's request for planning for public events and had suggested that such planning has become necessary. I want to ask you a few follow-up questions on that. First, do you know what actions the Boston Police Department took toward people on the list as the result of them being on that list?
So I think this has become a little in certain national and even international spheres. You know, is this a Nixon-like tactic? Is this a list of people who are being persecuted or silenced in some way? I will just give a little context for when that communication even took place, which was right after a meeting that had been requested by our public safety agencies with some members of my team. This was about a little over a year ago in June of 2022, following 4 months of protesters at early morning, almost every single day outside my house and coming, following me to events, even walking to school on one occasion, chasing after the kids and me as I tried to get them to school. And then one particularly stressful experience for the family was in the Dorchester Day Parade, where it goes all the way up Dorchester Ave. And for 90 minutes as we marched, there was a group that, you know, my kids used to come to every single parade that we were in from the time I was on the city council. It's just something that they're excited and joyful to be part of. And this was the first time where we had to really reevaluate 90 minutes where there were megaphones shouting, yelling towards them. And so after that experience, within the next week or so, as we were preparing for the next parade to come, the Bunker Hill Day Parade, there's a couple in quick succession, BPD said, can we talk about what should happen so that this experience doesn't happen again for any children along the route?
To clarify, people were addressing your children during the
march. We were marching together. It was my family, some of our team members and volunteers and folks from the community. And they kind of got in the parade with us in very close quarters. And even as the parade organizer said, you're not in the parade, you're not a registered member of the parade, they just came with us for multiple miles, just nonstop yelling. And it was a very difficult experience. I, you know, wanted to make sure, you know, my kids haven't come to every parade. They've very rarely come to parades since then, mm-hmm. Just because we never know. But it was a request from BPD to say, can we be better prepared for the next parade so we have a safety plan? We know what might happen, just because that kind of experience is not something that anyone should go through.
So understood in that context is helpful. And I will ask again, do you know if the BPD took any actions toward the people on the list as a result of them being on that list when you gave it to
them? From what I remember, I don't think a large group, I'm trying to remember if they were individuals, but I don't think that, I'm not sure if anyone even came to, in terms of following the family and harassing different people. I don't think anyone ended up coming to the Bunker Hill Parade. The preparations were specifically
for
that parade. And so it was requested by the police captain who was in charge of that geographic area covering Charlestown.
Have you since then had any other requests for similar lists?
I wasn't in that meeting even, so that was kind of from my team directly. To be honest, we plan very closely now for every single public event that we have. Last year, there were multiple of our neighborhood coffee hours in the parks that were similarly disrupted with megaphones and no one could hear anything or ask any questions of cabinet officials or me or anyone.
And at one point, you moved a press conference inside.
It was kind of nonstop for a period. And, you know, I think in this moment, we see across the country that it can be a little bit of a thin line between harassment and choosing to ignore laws or rules about what can happen, and you know, believing that disagreement and protest justifies behavior that can cross the line. It's a very thin line between that and more concerning instances that then veer towards violence. And we see that in you know, I've heard from many people in elected office in other parts of the country that many of these safety preparations are more necessary everywhere right now. Some members of that list, just in terms of who showed up at the Dorchester parade and refused to comply with the parade organizers' rules and what was asked there, they have multiple demonstrated record of arrests that were related to assaulting others or being in public places that made it unsafe for others. Even more recently, a case of, it seems, attempted murder from someone who was on that list and had been outside my house as well. So
this is the North End business owner. I apologize that his name is not on my mind right now. But the North End business owner who was caught on video and has since been accused of trying to shoot someone else in the North End over a long-term dispute. Mendoza is his last name. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And there have, you know, it's, again, it's, I don't want to make this all about me. I have been in the public eye, and when it happens to me, there tends to be more coverage. But many of my staff members in different, more visible positions have been just as targeted. There have been events at City Hall, you know, there's always been a history in Boston of voicing your opinion, and we welcome that. And I've been in this arena for a long time and choose to stay in it because I love the chance to really talk to someone and understand where what they're thinking and why and how we can come to something that can reflect a shared understanding of where the city should go. But there's a difference between protesting and expressing your opinion in a public space like City Hall, for example, forget someone's home. There's a difference between that and banging on the doors and making people feel unsafe because it's just crossing the line. And unfortunately, that's part of what it means to be in this world today.
All right. And by the way, it was Patrick Mendoza of Monica's Trattoria in the North End. We'll end it there. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu here with us for Mondays with the Mayor. Mayor Wu, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.